In the past 2 weeks, the number of cases of COVID-19 outside China has increased 13-fold.
1 year ago today, the Director General of the World Health Organization made it all official.
COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
March 11th is the same day Mississippi saw its first confirmed case.
This is not unexpected, based on our experience.
The first case in Louisiana was confirmed just a couple days before on March 9th.
A Jefferson Parish resident who was hospitalized in Orleans Parish.
On March 13th, it popped up in Alabama.
I'm reporting that Alabama has identified its first case of COVID-19 disease.
And from there, the number of cases quickly ticked up, and our lives were transformed.
The mask, the gloves, the hand sanitizer, keeping the staff as separate as possible.
Pretty much every patient is very sick.
Bourbon Street is empty, the shops on Magazine Street are closed, and masses are canceled at St. Louis Cathedral.
I am announcing a statewide mandatory mask wearing effective starting tomorrow.
It was so hard because I couldn't get in none of my classes. The teachers weren't answering none of the calls.
I think the hardest part has been having to watch people die alone. I'm so sick of that.
More than a million people in Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana have been diagnosed with the coronavirus. Tens of thousands of lives have been lost. In the midst of the loss, the pain, and uncertainty, messaging from state leaders in the region was all over the place. But the one thing we've heard again and again,
COVID-19 is not going to just go away.
This is going to get much worse before it gets better.
I know it is not easy. I know it is not fair. I also know it is not over.
And 1 year later, it still is not over. This is a year like no other, COVID-19 in the Gulf States. I'm Karen Brown with Mississippi Public Broadcasting. In recent months, MPB has been working with WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, WWNO in New Orleans, and NPR to cover important issues in the region. It's a collaboration called the Gulf States Newsroom. During a time when many of us are reflecting and marking anniversaries, reporters from each local station are revisiting big stories they've covered during the pandemic, from education to healthcare. We'll look at what's changed and what may never be the same. What have we learned? What changes are here to stay? Later in the program, the new Gulf States Newsroom regional reporters will talk about stories on the horizon. But we start today by checking in with some of the people most affected in the early days of the pandemic. During the first wave of the pandemic, meat and poultry processing plants were the source of major coronavirus outbreaks. Mississippi's $2.6 billion poultry industry employs thousands of workers who have continued to work during the pandemic. In May of 2020, MPB senior reporter Desiree Frazier reported on the concerns advocates and union leaders had about the risks for poultry plant workers. She joins me now. Hi, Desiree.
Hi, Karen.
So take us back to May. What was happening with poultry plants?
Well, when the pandemic started, there was an order that plants had to stay open. Meat was sold out. Poultry workers were considered essential. And there was a lot of safety concerns. In these plants, hundreds of people worked shoulder to shoulder. And back in May, I talked to Francine Jefferson with Mississippi's Poor People's Campaign. She said poultry plants pay low wages and the majority of employees are Latino and African American. And she was hearing from workers who were afraid.
They say, I have to go to work. Who's going to feed my children? How am I going to pay my bills? Or if I don't go to work, they're going to take points and I'm going to lose my job and these kinds of things.
You checked in with Francine Jefferson. What's changed?
Francine Jefferson says conditions for workers at the Pico poultry plants in Canton, Mississippi have improved. She says workers are getting personal protective equipment and temperatures are checked. But she says the workers she knows in Canton don't have sick leave and they do feel compelled to go to work when they don't feel well because they need the money.
You also checked in with some of the poultry plant workers. What has life been like for them this past year?
I spoke with Eber. He's a poultry worker who asked that we not use his full name or reveal the company he works for because he doesn't want to jeopardize his job. The 43-year-old says the plant he works at provides PPE, but not when the coronavirus pandemic began. Ebers says he contracted COVID-19 last summer and was out of work for 6 weeks.
Me quedé en casa. La norma era que me quedara en casa 15 días.
He says he spent three of them in the hospital. Ebert talked about having health insurance coverage and the company paying his salary while he was out sick. He also says the company doctor would call him periodically to see how he was doing. There have been improvements at the facility since the coronavirus pandemic began, according to Ebert, such as temperatures being taken when employees enter the facility. They're required to wear masks and gloves. He says they can wash their hands as often as they like and their sanitizer. And he says the work areas are kept much cleaner. The drawback, Eber says they still work shoulder to shoulder and there's about 100 people on his line. And also he says he is concerned about safety because their masks get wet while they're working and they have to take them off. They do put on clean ones, but with people constantly wiping their faces and switching out masks, they are exposed to the person next to them for a period of time.
I want to zoom out a little bit. What's the toll that this has taken on the region?
There's a lot that we don't know about what's happened in this industry, but we do know that people have been sick. They're doing dangerous work that's only getting more dangerous. Using public data, the nonprofit Food and Environment Reporting Network found that as of February 21st, at least 57,000 meatpacking and poultry workers have been infected with COVID-19 nationally, and more than 280 have died. I spoke with Angela Stisi. She is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She spent 6 years in Mississippi working to advance poultry workers' rights, and she also authored a book called Scratching Out a Living. Stisi explained that the work is dangerous and has one of the highest injury rates of any industry in the country. Like with everything with the pandemic, there are issues before, they have only gotten worse.
I talked to one person at a plant in Scott County who was sick and did end up staying home. And he said, I don't even know why I'm staying home because everybody I know in the plants has COVID and half of them are at work.
What's being done to address these safety concerns?
The first stimulus bill provided that medical coverage would be provided for sick workers, but companies with 500 or more employees were exempt, and many of the poultry plants are multinational corporations with thousands of employees. Professor Stisi says,
I think that the only way that this industry is going to change is if our government steps up and begins to regulate it.
There was a congressional hearing last week in Washington, D.C., that included labor concerns surrounding the meat and poultry industries. And on the first day of the Biden administration, new guidelines were issued to improve workplace safety in settings where people are most at risk of contracting COVID-19. But there's still a lot more work to be done.
MPB senior reporter Desiree Frazier, thanks so much for the update, Desiree.
You're welcome.
This time last year, it was almost impossible to imagine shutting down school for hundreds of millions of students and teachers. But like so many things during the pandemic, the seemingly impossible became a reality. Virtual learning became a standard part of life. But as districts toggled back and forth between in-person and online learning, many students have been left behind. Education reporter Aubrey Juhas with WWNO in New Orleans has been following this story. Welcome, Aubrey.
Thanks for having me.
So, going back to the beginning of this school year, a lot of schools were still closed and students were facing a lot of challenges in the fall.
That's right. So some districts did decide to start the school year in person, but many opted to start virtually. And that's because they were concerned about the high number of coronavirus cases in their communities. Now, the first challenge many of these schools faced was getting students online. So in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, broadband access is limited and many students don't have computer access at home. For months, some children couldn't learn online, so they had to use paper packets instead. And the only way they could check in with their teachers was by phone. So in New Orleans, the district eventually was able to purchase laptops and hotspots. But it soon became clear that even with the necessary technology, some students were still having problems, like 13-year-old Faith Jackson.
It was so hard because I couldn't get in none of my classes. Once I finally got in, they was giving me all these misses assignments that I never got. And they just expected them at a certain time. So I didn't know what to do with. So I was really lost.
So when I met Jackson in October, she was enrolled in an intervention program for students who were struggling with online learning. And fortunately, she was doing much better. But the cycle she described is something a lot of kids have experienced this year, and many still haven't gotten the help that they need.
So in most of the schools in the region, students are back in the classroom at this point, but that doesn't mean things are back to normal?
Yeah. For starters, many students haven't returned to their classrooms even when they're physically open. For example, in New Orleans, as well as in Birmingham, early, you know, surveys of parents said that about 40% of them plan to keep their kids at home because they were concerned about, you know, safety, or they thought that the quality of in-person learning with all of these safety mitigation measures was going to be compromised. Now, the other problem is that for schools that have opened, a lot of them haven't been consistently open. So we've seen this, you know, in Birmingham and New Orleans, across the entire country, when schools opened early, they then had to respond to these subsequent surges of cases. And this constant sense of uncertainty, you know, has been exhausting for parents, for students, for teachers, and it's made long-term planning impossible. And for kids who have been back in the classroom, everything's different, and teachers have to split their attention, a lot of cases, between teaching to kids who are at home, so they're looking at that screen, and then they have to toggle to the students who are right in front of them, which is a new experience for everyone.
During the past year, we've been hearing a lot about missing students. What's going on there?
Yeah, so basically all schools have experienced a drop in enrollment. And a large drop we're seeing is, you know, parents who are saying, oh, I'm not going to send my kids to kindergarten this year. You know, in the three states here, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, kindergarten isn't mandatory. We don't have a widespread pre-K system. So a lot of those drops have to do with kids staying at home. And the concern with that is it might mean that we have kids who are not as ready for first grade as they typically would. When we also talk about missing students, we're looking at attendance concerns. So we're looking at districts that even after they've come back in person, they're dealing with attendance drops that are around 10%, which can, you know, translate to thousands of children missing school on any given day. So in New Orleans, Mayor LaToya Cantrell, she said the source of the problem is in some cases teenagers are working jobs during school hours. She reminded businesses that that is illegal. And I think this really shows us that, you know, some students are being driven to really need to contribute due to the economic fallout that we're seeing. It's important to note that many of these students were habitually absent before the pandemic. So it's another example of how the coronavirus has, you know, exacerbated pre-existing inequalities.
There are a lot of concerns about students falling behind. What's the plan to get things back on track?
Yeah, so we know that there's this widespread consensus that significant learning loss has occurred. Some school leaders argue that, you know, if we go back to the status quo, it won't be enough to help get these students back on track. And frankly, you know, the original structure wasn't really working well for them to begin with. So we are seeing, you know, a few people calling for what some would consider to be pretty radical change. And in Birmingham, Superintendent Mark Sullivan, he's advocating for a year-round school calendar. Here's Sullivan speaking at a recent town hall.
We are in an educational crisis. And if we don't do something now, many of our students will never recover from this COVID-19 educational loss. We have to do this now.
So very few districts in the country teach students year-round, and there are no year-round districts right now in Alabama. But it doesn't actually, you know, it doesn't mean adding more school days to the calendar. It means spreading instructional days across the entire year. So most models have children learn for 9 weeks, followed by 2 or 3 weeks of break. And Sullivan says it's not just about getting in more instructional time, but it means providing students with meals and a safe place to go year-round.
This past year has been so complicated and a real roller coaster for students, teachers, and parents. But when it comes to virtual learning, a lot of this was out of reach for these school districts before. Have there been some silver linings in all of this?
Yeah, there have been. Some districts now have more computers than they do students, whereas previously maybe they had a computer lab at their school. And that really changes the way, you know, students can learn. Now, internet access, you know, continues to complicate this because it is an issue. We know that our region, you know, lacks broadband access. At the same time, because internet has become more essential, it's now an issue that, you know, leaders are actively working on. So that's potentially another, you know, area for improvement. The last thing isn't exactly a silver lining, but it is a light at the end of the tunnel. So we're at a point now where teachers are eligible for the vaccine in all three states. Of course, at the federal level, the goal is to have most K-12 schools open during the first 100 days of the Biden administration. And that goal has largely been met in this region. So the hope is that vaccine rollout will likely provide families and teachers with a greater sense of security and hopefully long-term stability moving forward.
WWNO's education reporter, Aubrey Juhas. Thanks, Aubrey.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to a special broadcast from the Gulf States Newsroom, a year like no other, COVID-19 in the Gulf States. I'm Karen Brown. Nursing homes were hot spots of the outbreak. As of February, more than 160,000 residents and staff of nursing homes and other long-term care facilities died in Alabama, roughly 2,000 deaths. Mary Scott Hodgin covers health for WBHM in Birmingham, and she joins me now. Hi, Mary Scott.
Hey, good to be here.
You did a heartwarming story in August about a nurse at a nursing home in Marion, Alabama, who was trying to bring a little joy to residents there.
Yes, her name is Ashley Moore. And I first met her last year after seeing this video that was posted on Facebook. It was a video of her sitting at a nurse's station at the nursing home where she works, which is called Perry County Nursing Home. And in this video, Ashley was sitting at this desk and she was singing into the intercom system and she was just belting this gospel song.
I am weak.
And so it turns out that this was not Ashley's first time singing at the nursing home. She's been a nurse there for a few years. And before COVID, she would regularly sing with residents during activities. And, you know, with COVID, that kind of thing wasn't really possible. But it was also a really difficult time. And so the staff at the nursing home were kind of looking for ways to cheer people up. They started using the intercom system to read prayers and inspiring messages. And Ashley decided to belt gospel hymns. And so people really, they loved it.
What a lovely thing to do in the midst of all this tragedy. Now, that was back in August. How's Ashley doing now?
Yes, I checked in with her recently, and she says things are looking up.
Things are so much better. Like, at first, when we interviewed before, we were keeping everybody in their rooms, like, nobody could come out. But now, you know, they can come out masked up now, as long as they have their mask on. They're still doing activities. We even had a Mardi Gras parade.
So that sound at the end there is from the Mardi Gras parade that they had last month. So you see, they're still trying to find these moments of joy. Ashley is still singing to residents when possible. And she says, you know, things may never really be back to normal, but COVID cases are down. Health providers have been vaccinating residents and staff. Ashley herself has already gotten both doses of one of the mRNA vaccines. So, you know, that's provided a lot of hope for everyone, and especially nursing homes, which have been so impacted by the pandemic.
Let's talk a little more broadly about the impact on nursing homes in the region. You called some officials in each of the states. What are they saying about the past year?
I mean, yeah, in all three states and really across the country, nursing homes were hit hard. They account for a significant portion of deaths from COVID-19. Across, you know, this region, thousands of nursing home residents have died. And when I was talking to people about the impact of this, they brought up how confusing and frustrating things have been, especially early on. Here's Denise Botcher. She's the director of AARP Louisiana.
It came fast and furious and ravaged nursing homes. I don't know of not one nursing home that wasn't affected. And so the states really learned from each other how to combat the illness.
And so, you know, if you remember, at first, there were nationwide delays in testing and access to testing, a shortage of personal protective equipment. And in nursing homes and long-term care facilities, there were calls for more communication and transparency about what was happening inside. Because almost overnight, visitation had stopped. Loved ones couldn't visit and see what was going on. There were reports of people learning days later about COVID outbreaks. And these facilities were really overwhelmed. Staff were overworked. Another thing everyone who I talked to really emphasized was the impact of isolation. You know, how a lot of residents have been really lonely and confused about what's going on. And that is still a concern right now because visitation is still restricted.
Nursing homes were some of the first places to be eligible for the vaccine. But as we know, the rollout has been a little complicated.
For sure, yeah. In all three states, the vaccine rollout was off to a slower start, and there have been delays and confusion. But the pace is picking up now. The states are all participating in the federal program with Walgreens and CVS pharmacies to vaccinate residents and staff in long-term care facilities. For the most part, nursing homes and advocates say this is going pretty well. Tens of thousands of residents and employees in each state are already vaccinated.
Mary Scott, you have been immersed in this and all of this reporting. How are you handling it? How are you doing?
Well, you know, it's been challenging. It's been difficult to hear the stories, you know, from people who are really impacted firsthand, whether that's the medical providers, the nurses who are caring for these patients and have seen, you know, these really dramatic waves. It's just affected everyone and everybody's life because you're really seeing, you know, what a pandemic can do and what it can mean. And we've never really had to live through that before. So it's an economic story. It's a political story. It's a health story for sure. But it's much more than just health.
Mary Scott Hodgen covers health for WBHM in Birmingham. Thanks so much, Mary Scott.
Thank you.
Now we're going to talk about some more of the ways that the pandemic has shaped our region and some of the stories we've yet to tell. In recent months, Mississippi Public Broadcasting, WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama, and WWNO in New Orleans have all been working together to cover important issues in the region. It's a collaboration called the Gulf States Newsroom. We've added more reporting power to the region by bringing on three reporters covering healthcare, criminal justice, and wealth and poverty across the three states. Those reporters are here with me now to talk about their work and the stories they'll be following as the pandemic continues. First, Becca Schimmel. She's based at MPB, and she's covering criminal justice across the three states. Good to have you, Becca.
Good to be here.
Shalina Chatlani is covering healthcare, and she's based at WWNO in New Orleans. Welcome, Shalina.
Hey, happy to be here.
Last but not least, Stephen Basaha is covering wealth, poverty, and economic development. He's based at WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
Shalina, let's start with you. Of course, healthcare has been at the center of the pandemic. Beyond COVID-19, what are you following on your beat? What are the big healthcare issues in the region?
Well, people across the South often deal with multiple chronic health issues. We're talking high rates of diabetes, high rates of infant mortality, particularly in rural Black communities. These are issues that are still happening and are compounded by the pandemic. There's also, of course, a long history of institutional racism within the South and a historical lack of access in care that many communities of color are dealing with. Some political issues are prominent here, too, like across the Gulf states. Louisiana is the only state that has expanded Medicaid when that option was available. You know, so what does that mean for the other states that didn't expand Medicaid?
When it comes to the pandemic specifically, what issues are you hoping to follow?
Well, certainly the equity challenges, like who gets access to the coronavirus vaccine and who doesn't? Which communities are dying at higher rates of coronavirus and why? Another thing I'll be following is how the pandemic has changed access to other social services like food distribution or housing services, which can also impact a person's health. These are the types of ideas that are known as the social determinants of health, which are issues that I'm really interested in digging into on this beat.
Becca, you're focusing on criminal justice. Why is this a relevant issue for the region?
Yeah, well, this region has some of the highest rates of incarceration, Louisiana having the highest in the nation and Mississippi following in second place there. And kind of looking at, you know, why are there such high rates of incarceration? What's driving that? And what are the different states doing about it? And another thing I'm really interested in is, when does someone stop serving their sentence? You know, when are people paroled and what does that look like? What kind of help are they getting to rehabilitate? And what are the purposes of our prisons and jails and really just our criminal justice system? And with that, you kind of have yourself at the intersection of wealth and poverty and health, and all those issues relate themselves into the criminal justice system.
Now, what stories will you be watching related to the pandemic?
Yeah, I'll be looking at when inmates are offered the vaccine, how those vaccination efforts go. I believe Louisiana has started giving the COVID vaccine shot to offenders. Some are willing to take it, some are not, but prisons and jails are overcrowded areas in our region, and because of that, COVID has a really great chance to spread in those areas and could cause some long-term health effects, as we've seen with some long haulers, and kind of just paying attention to how that affects different inmates across the region.
Stephen, your focus is wealth and poverty. What will you be digging into for the region?
Well, similar to what Becca was saying about this region having the highest rates of incarceration, we also have the highest rates of poverty in the Gulf states. Close to 1 in 5 people living in Louisiana and Mississippi live in poverty. Alabama's not doing much better. And these are numbers from before the pandemic. And I'm very much interested in looking at the different factors that lead people into poverty, help them get out of poverty, or trap them in there. Those are things like who owns what, as far as things like land, businesses, how that plays into who's wealthy and who's poor, safety net programs, housing, generational wealth, food insecurity, and also looking at the history of all these different factors, because many of them go back decades, if not centuries in some cases in our country.
The pandemic has, of course, taken a huge economic toll. What will you be watching specifically related to the pandemic?
Well, many of the issues that are so bad now after the pandemic that are hurting people economically, they're the same things that they were hurting them before. It just exacerbated by COVID. We're talking about unemployment, housing, hunger amongst children. Since the pandemic started, more than 28% of children in Louisiana often do not have enough to eat each week. There's also a lot of struggles with Black-owned businesses in particular closing. And also be taking a look at what comes out of Washington with the next round of federal support for businesses and our economy, seeing how that plays out in our local region.
We look forward to hearing and reading all of this important coverage from all of you. Thanks so much. I've been talking with Becca Schimmel, Shalina Chatlani, and Stephen Bisaha. They are reporters for the Gulf States Newsroom. And the Gulf States Newsroom will be working to bring you stories from across Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, because there are so many more stories to tell. As the vaccine rollout continues,
Tier 1 will be expanded to include teachers and support staff working on site.
As infection rates start to trend down,
We do see some bright spots finally. Our hospitalization numbers are as good as they have looked since very early summer.
As states start to lift restrictions,
this new order removes all of our county mask mandates and allows businesses to operate at full capacity without.
But at that time, it will become a matter of personal responsibility and not a government mandate.
And as we discover a new sense of normal.
When COVID-19 is over, I think families and friends should reunite.
This has been a year like no other, COVID-19 in the Gulf States, a production of the Gulf States Newsroom, a partnership between Mississippi Public Broadcasting, WBHM in Birmingham, and WWNO in New Orleans. This show was edited and produced by Priska Neely with help from Michael Guidry. I'm Karen Brown. Thanks for listening.